Mr. Chairman, thank you for your words of welcome and good evening to you all.
I should mention right now that I'm not going to miss this opportunity of coming all this way and leaving without gaining your own objectives, your own impressions of the farming and political scene, so I look forward to a fairly healthy discussion at the end of the talk. I've noticed that Mr. Whitlam often starts with a comforting thought by saying that Australia's inflation problems are really no different to those of other countries. The only problem is, however, that they're many times worse here. A parallel comforting thought would be that our farmers don't really face any problems that are different to farmers in other countries. But once again, the real problem is that our problems are much worse than those of other countries as far as farming goes. This quotation from Canada Month in August 1971 shows the similarity between us right now in 1975 and that existing in Saskatchewan in 1971. I'll quote, "Hovering over all the producers was the gnawing uneasiness deriving from the antics of the central government in Ottawa." That's our equivalent to Canberra. "Its farm and agricultural policies have made pawns of the farmers of the West who once had felt they were independent and free to make their own decisions, who felt that they had once been able to plan their future, confident that the unknowns and imponderables with which they must deal were only wind and rainfall, rust and grasshoppers, heat and blight and world markets. But the real enemy that was now emerging were politicians who were determined to do them good." End of quote. Professor Milton Friedman, the noted US economist who visited Australia earlier this year, has contrasted the difference between the hope and the actual results from government programs by saying that there is no such odour so bad as that which arises from goodness tainted. He stated that, and I'll quote him again, "If I knew of a man coming to my house to do me good, I would run for my life." He warned us of the motives of people trying to do good at someone else's expense and suggested that we should add to the Constitution the right guaranteeing every man the right to do good at his own expense. I've just spent 2 weeks in two countries that are considerably more free enterprise oriented than Australia, and these countries don't have our inflation problems. They do have an increasing rate of productivity, an increasing standard of living, and an increasing sense of national and individual achievement. It made me a little envious to meet many Australians who have moved to Taiwan and Hong Kong, and they can look forward to reading good news in their daily papers instead of this constant barrage of politics. My interest in politics, incidentally, is that I live for the day when we don't have to be preoccupied with politics, when we can return to managing our own affairs with a limited concept of government and bureaucratic intervention. Looking back on Australia from a distance, as seen by the overseas newspapers, we appear to be a nation of frustrated people. The socialists are bitter because their socialist schemes have not produced the results they expected. The intended beneficiaries are unhappy because the promised utopia did not materialise. Aboriginals were promised immediate equality and prosperity. The aged were given increases in social security payments only to find that inflation gobbled up the gains. Union labour was given everything it asked for, but the cost of living skyrocketed, and some unions have priced their members' services right out of the market. Farmers were given price supports and payments, but found that these benefits were offset by depressed market prices and reduced sales. Anti-poverty programs are failing to reduce poverty, and socialised medicine looks like going the same way that the national medicine schemes have gone in Canada and the UK, where it's become completely abused by both the recipients and the providers of the services, to such a degree that the country generally will be unable to carry the burden of such programs. In a desperate effort to make all their schemes work, the federal politicians have voted vast increases in power for the federal government, the excuse being that only the federal government can provide enough money and with sufficient speed to break the barriers that were slowing their so-called social and economic reforms. I can't help feeling a little sad at seeing this sort of thing happen to a country who is so young and so full of potential. And a lot of us feel the same way, and that's how the Workers' Party has come into being. The basic difference between the Workers' Party and the Socialist parties, yes, I mean all the major parties, there's nothing much to separate them, apart from the fact that the Labour Party is probably a little more honest about its socialist intentions. The Labour Party preaches socialism and practices socialism. The Liberal Party preaches free enterprise and practices socialism. The Country Party wants socialism for the farmers and free enterprise for everyone else. They urge a return to free enterprise except in country areas. They believe in competition provided that egg, meat, lamb and wheat boards control all prices and prevent all competition. They encourage price fixation in all states to prevent unequal opportunity between the various states. They believe in subsidies for farmers and high taxation to pay for it. If the Workers' Party is the only free enterprise party, you may think it's strange or paradoxical that we have chosen the name Workers' Party. A worker is anyone who works with his hands, or his brains, or his savings. He is any person in this society who lives his life by his own effort and his own enterprise. We think it's a good name, and it shows up the many instances of people previously using the name when they really weren't workers at all. We have a basic fundamental principle, and this is written in our platform and reproduced on most of our literature, and I'll just quote it. No man or group of men has the right to initiate the use of force, fraud or coercion against another man or group of men. I'll refer to that fundamental principle several times through the talk. Another way of putting it is that we believe in maximum freedom of the individual as long as no one interferes with anyone else's freedom, or as long as no one trespasses on anyone else's rights. Another way again of putting it is that no one owns anyone's life but his own, and no one's life belongs to people to dispose of it as they wish. In other words, we believe completely in the practice of free market, willing exchange, private property, limited government principles. To us, free enterprise is defined by the phrase a fair field and no favour, implying that the opposite to this, being socialism, is described as an unfair field with favours to some at the expense of others. Just recently in Kalgoorlie, a well-known Labour Member of Parliament defined socialism for me by using the story of Paddy and Mick, the two farmers. And Paddy said to Mick, "Now listen, Mick, you can't be serious when you tell me you're a socialist." And Mick said, "Ah, but Paddy, I am a socialist. Indeed, I am a socialist." And Paddy said, "Well, that means that if you've got two horses, you'd give me one horse." And Mick said, "Ah, you know I would, Paddy." Paddy said, "If you've got two cows, that means you'd give me one of your cows." Mick said, "Oh, indeed, I would give you one of my cows." And Paddy then said, "That means if you've got two pigs, you'd give me one of your pigs." And Mick said, "Ah, Paddy, be buggered, you know that I've got two pigs." And that is the fallacy of socialism. They're very good at spending someone else's money, but when the crunch comes, they won't be in it. For socialism to work, it's necessary for us to surrender many of our freedoms. And I think if we look at it, we'll see that this has happened to an alarming degree in the last 2 or 3 years. Freedom is quite a peculiar commodity in a sense that some people don't quite know how to live with or how to grasp the concept of freedom. Because it means also that for a society to be free, a great many people must exhibit a much higher level of tolerance for individual eccentricity than has ever hitherto prevailed. Selling the freedom philosophy is sometimes difficult, because freedom means putting up with a lot of things you don't like. It means living with a lot of people you can barely stand. Freedom of speech and freedom of press, of religion and economics means that other people will say, they'll print, they'll believe and they'll produce things that we may find distasteful ourselves. Freedom doesn't come cheap, it costs. And those unable or unwilling to pay the price will never achieve freedom, nor will they retain the amount of freedom that we have at the present time. Freedom might cost something, but in this respect it's no different to anything else that's worthwhile. When I spoke of selling the freedom philosophy, I should qualify that word selling. I want you to believe me that this is not a dogma that can be belligerently rammed down the throats or into the minds of people. All we can do is bring certain thoughts to the brink of your consciousness, and it's up to you to accept these concepts or reject them as valid alternatives to the many compulsory government programs. We feel as long as you've had an opportunity to examine these alternatives, then that's fine. The option of what you do is yours. We wouldn't be here, we wouldn't be pursuing this direction if we didn't feel that these are valid alternatives, and if the potential of the free enterprise system as a whole is allowed to, it will solve most of our problems today. Back on the aspect of freedom, there are two main facets of human nature in this respect. The first one is a biological urge to be free. This is a positive facet, and the freedom philosophy of the Workers' Party is what appeals to anyone of the individualist temperament. That is, people who have no desire to control other people's lives. Those of us who find that there's enough challenge in running our own life, let alone meddling with other people. It's those who derive sufficient satisfaction from making their own decisions, accepting their own responsibilities, those who are really their own persons. The opposite mentality to yours is the bureaucratic mentality. They usually derive pleasure from making other people twitch, I'm sure you've met them, from stopping things from happening. Most of them couldn't make it on their own, so they have to really enslave and live off others. What's the connection between the freedom philosophy and the people of the individualist temperament, such as yourselves? We think it's the only system that you can find compatible with your temperament, and the only problem previously has been that this freedom philosophy has not really been accessible to people in Australia. The Workers' Party has made this available in the written or recorded form, so now it is accessible for anyone who'd like to give it a hearing. But as I mentioned before, it's no attempt to brainwash anyone, because our whole concept is one of voluntary approach to any ideas and concepts that may be offered. I spoke of the biological urge to be free as one of the positive human facet, and the other facet of human nature is the all too human wish to shirk responsibility. That's the lazy, bludger type parasitical component that I suppose is on all of us, but most of us manage to keep it under control. It's a negative facet, and it's the facet that explains why so many people find something appealing about socialism. The tidal movement of socialism in the 20th century is really no mystery. There will always be plenty of people who will follow anyone that has a sales pitch that says, I know how to run your life better than you do. Leave your moments to infallible me. You know, I'll take over and make all the decisions. Many socialist leaders, in their know-it-allness, sincerely believe this to be their role. And they are sincere about it. I must hand them that. And they're encouraged into so believing by the millions of people that are shying away from self-responsibility and are looking for shepherds and sheepdogs. Of course, the fact is that no dictocrat knows how to run the life of any human being, let alone the lives of millions. We realise that none of us can be perfect, and that's an established fact. The only difference is that if an individual is imperfect, his sphere of influence is not very great, so not much damage is done. But when that same imperfect individual is a bureaucrat or a politician, his effect becomes magnified considerably, because he becomes one person over millions. Daily we observe these same dictocrats themselves acknowledging that such and such a plan has not come up to their expectations. Lacking the capacity to recognise their know-nothingness in some respects, and stirred on by a passion to rule, they don't repeal these errors, they leave them on the statute books and add another and another endlessly. Error, unless discerned, breeds error, just the same as weeds breed weeds. The errors proliferate into our thousands of government departments, federal, state and local. Millions of errors backed by force is what we see now, and it's called planned chaos. Such is the nature of the mess we're in, and the name of the mess is socialism. If I could spend just a few more moments on these general principles, and then we'll return to farming. The Workers' Party doesn't believe that the way of honestly solving the problems of today is by trying to out-bribe the voters or offering bigger and more grandiose schemes bought at the expense of you, the voters, yourselves. It might be interesting to compare the present-day politicians with the somewhat corrupt politicians of the 18th century who did at least use their own money to bribe the electorate. Politicians nowadays use public money to pay the election bribes. Please don't think that I'm attacking all politicians, because most of them are, in fact, sincerely representing their electorates. Most of the problems have been caused by us, the people, by asking the politicians and government to take over our responsibilities and do too much. The task that now confronts the politicians is almost an impossible one of satisfying all the pressure groups who want something done at somebody else's expense. It's an unenviable task, and I certainly don't envy their challenge, but we have asked them to do all these things and put them into that position. It's too bad some of them didn't learn to say no. One of the main advocates of the free market economics is Professor von Mises, who was once asked what he would do if given power over people. His answer was that he would abdicate. He wasn't shirking any responsibility by giving an answer like that. He was simply recognising the power and effectiveness of individual human action and individual responsibility. Instead of this type of thinking, we see today each rapidly expanding strata of government encroaching on the next strata downward. As an example, we see the so-called Australian or federal centralist government encroaching on functions such as education and health, which incidentally we don't think are government monopolies anyway. But these two aspects of government influence are clearly indicated by our constitution as being state responsibilities. It's not only a provision of the Australian Constitution, but also a basic principle of good government that no function should be assumed by the higher authority, the Commonwealth, which can be effectively performed by the lower authority, state government. Unfortunately, most federal politicians deny this principle. It's also a necessary principle, though unfortunately there's no constitutional provision for it, that state governments should not undertake any function which can be efficiently performed by local government. Local government in their turn should not undertake functions which should be performed by voluntary agencies or individuals. The role of continual government meddling has bred this widespread financial irresponsibility. Any government department's spending money, which has been provided for it by somebody else, will spend much more lightheartedly than if it has to raise its funds from the unpleasant chore of taxing exactly the same people that will have to vote for it or against it at the next election. I believe that it all starts with us, the individuals, each one of us that has unfortunately allowed governments in the past to con us on so many occasions. If we could straighten out our own thinking, we might order our lives more effectively, and if a significant number of people did this, then the society, which is us, would begin to square itself away. It's a slow way to go, but it's the only way to go if we want to solve these problems. We've got the ingredients for restoring the society, but it only needs the recognitions of the problems and the will and the individual decision to get back to individual reliance and independence that originally triggered off decisions in men like yourselves when you decided to be farmers in the first place. The application of this Workers' Party fundamental principle that I mentioned earlier to almost any issue gives us a consistency of attitude that's become the envy of many Liberal Party members. We don't have the problems such as they recently encountered with the conscription issue at their state conference. They're without any basic philosophy on such issues, so it's predictable that they should come up with two completely diametrically opposed resolutions at the conference. By applying our fundamental principle, the Workers' Party attitude to conscription must be that no one owns anyone's life, so no one's at liberty to dispose of it as they wish. I don't own your life, so there's no way in the world that I can force you to go away and fight for me or fight for my property. We believe that a voluntary army will provide the answer. We don't think you have to conscript policemen or traffic policemen or stuntmen or any other group of individuals, so we see absolutely no reason to conscript soldiers. Our attitude to economics is that we see the continual policy of government intervention practiced by all of Australia's major political parties as demonstrating the similarity between democratic socialism and totalitarian socialism. And we offer, in the field of economics, the only antidote of free market, willing exchange, private property, and limited government. I've been quite mystified at some of the way some of our critics use the word extremist. It's left-wing extremist or right-wing extremist in describing the Workers' Party. I'm mystified because I can't see how you can be called an extremist if you're talking about a freedom philosophy. The word extremism is completely alien to freedom in any form, so I can't see just how we can be extremists, so I'll leave you to judge on that one. We don't see this political spectrum as being this straight line right and left wing that's often referred to. We see it more as being circular. We think of ourselves, of course, at the top being the freedom philosophy, individual responsibility bit. Going around in one curve on one side, that would go through socialism to communism to totalitarianism, which is dictatorship right at the bottom. On the other side of the circle, we'd go through the various stages of fascism through to totalitarianism, dictatorship right at the bottom. They're really both the same. If people want to call us some sort of a wing, I guess they'd have to call us upwing. The general attitude that we feel Australians have toward government, in that big government is good government, is not only naive, it's dangerous and it's expensive. The Workers' Party, in propagating the realisation that big government is dangerous and expensive, is drawing people's attention to the fact that most of our social problems today have come about because government has stepped into and stayed in areas where it should never have been. If we want to talk about examples of that, I'll have to come back some other night. The government, in becoming involved in these other areas, has in fact neglected its proper and essential roles, which could be defined as being three things. One, the defence of Australia. That's against external aggression. Two, the protection of honest Australians against criminals. You could call that against internal aggression. And the third one, the maintenance of the legal system to protect individuals' liberty and the property rights of individuals. The socialists see a rather extensive role for government in our society, and to quote from the Labor Party platform, they refer to their aim as being government ownership of the means of production, government ownership of the means of distribution. The means of production and the means of distribution are us, a lot of us. So that really means government control of you. The socialists believe in the economic policies of John Maynard Keynes, and these economic policies and their inflationary results speak for themselves. Incidentally, one point here is that Keynes proposed that in times of economic slack, the government should get involved in all forms of activity, should print money, should artificially stimulate consumption. These proposals the politicians have naturally found most attractive and have utilised to the extreme. One aspect, however, that they've forgotten is that Keynes also proposed that once the slack had been taken up, the government should then get out of these activities. The only problem is that they don't get out. Have you ever heard of a government getting out of anything and handing it back to private enterprise? Bureaucracy proliferates. It's an essential characteristic of any bureaucracy that unless you keep pruning it, it will proliferate just like a ginger beer plant. I think David Reed was referring to the bureaucracy when he described it the other day as saying that it's now growing to plague proportions and it's even getting worse than fruit fly. On the other hand, the Workers' Party propagate the principles that the free market economy, and I mentioned von Mises, and I'll quote something that he said that he wrote in 1920, quote, "Where there is no free market, there's no pricing system. Without a pricing system, there's no economic calculation," end of quote. With these words, von Mises dismissed the possibility of economic calculation in a socialist society where the government owns or controls factors of production. This means that there is neither free market nor competitive pricing under socialism. Mises' reasoning has certainly been borne out by reports emanating from Russia. Attempts to allocate resources within the socialist countries so as to reduce economic malproduction have only led to noticeable malinvestment, production bottlenecks and shoddy merchandise. In the effort to reduce such economic imbalances, the current Russian planners are trying to improvise quasi-profit and loss systems. However, they failed to comprehend what Mises pointed out, that profits and losses cannot be known in the absence of private ownership and competitive bidding for the factors of production. The Russian socialists got themselves into the same jam as we have economically. If we follow the principle of government control of production facilities, it must necessarily follow that government reforms and legislation will not succeed in reducing economic malproduction as a free market would. Directly involving every one of us in the room here today involved with farming is the absolute lack of a free market for your produce. This is a prime cause for our problems today. To explain how we're living with the consequences of government-created problems, let me touch on another concept here. Broadly speaking, there are two types of people in Australia. It could be said that there are the producers and the parasites, but let's put it this way. The first class are those that have to live with the long-term consequences of their daily decisions, those for whom there is no escape, those who are stuck with the buck, there's no one else to pass the buck to. The second class are those who do not have to live with the long-term consequences of their daily decisions. This would include many of the public servants, many of the bureaucrats, and many of the politicians. For them, the option of changing horses, buck passing, and going on to greater things is the only way to go. Most of them are unsackable, and at the very worst, if they do get the sack, they stop working, but they're on a pension higher than many of your annual salaries. If they make a blunder like Jim Cairns when he underestimated the budget last year and spent $3 billion of your money that he didn't have, and at the same time printed money without backing, and if you and I do that, it's called counterfeiting. He pumped this money into the economy through the banks, encouraging people to borrow all in order to restore what he called confidence. And in fact, the only thing he achieved was a destruction of confidence, and he doubled the unemployment rate. Okay, he made a slight error, but it's certainly no real problem for him. He doesn't have to live with the long-term consequences. It's not his money he blew, it's your money. So that's what I mean when I say there are two classes of people. There's the free enterprise class and there's the other class. Back on the fundamental principle and the concept of applying it to issues today, if we could just look at what some people call the Aboriginal problem. We don't think there's an Aboriginal problem, we think there's a politician problem or a bureaucrat problem. Our Aboriginals have been politically forced to become members of that other class of people who don't have to live with the long-term consequences of their decisions. If we can look at our Workers' Party platform and see just what attitude we have in this direction, I'll just quote from the platform. Aboriginal Australians, on page 3. "We recognise that the rights of Australian Aborigines have been violated frequently, extensively and degradingly by successive governments. We advocate the repeal of all laws which violate individual rights. In particular, we advocate that land currently held in trust by various governments be returned to the Aboriginal Australians with full property rights, including the full ownership of minerals below the ground. This means that with proper and legal transfer of these assets to the Aboriginal communities, they'd have the rights to sell, develop, or do anything else they like with their own property. They then have a chance to achieve independence and self-sufficiency. They then have to live with the long-term consequences of any actions they took, and like you and I, if they so desired, they could sell their assets and spend it on wine, women and song. That decision's yours, and the same decision should, in a free country, be theirs. Getting back to farming, the lack of a free market is one very big problem facing us. Specifically talking about beef. We're the producers of beef, but we're the only one link. We're just one link in this complete chain of production and distribution. There's transport, abattoirs, butchering, wholesale, retail, and the others that I haven't thought of. I ask you, how is it that the producers are the only one link in that whole chain that's having its very lifeblood squeezed from it? How have we, the producers, lost our independence when we see all the other links in this chain able quite easily to pass on any inflation-caused costs onto the consumer, pass it on through the chain, but this single link of the producers, they're stuck with it? I put it to you that we surrendered our freedoms when we started taking favours from the government. When we accepted their vote-buying bribes like super bounties, subsidies and all the other little gimmicks. To quote from John Singleton, who recently said, "If any of you have read any serious political works like The Godfather, you'll realise that if you receive a big favour, you then owe a big favour." We voluntarily surrendered our freedom to sell on an open market. Okay, I'm in a relatively small way as a beef producer, but the percentages are just the same. I bought cows at $110 and now they're virtually unsaleable, so my problems are your problems. But being a simple-minded businessman, I thought I'd discovered a solution, because in Kalgoorlie we sell mining equipment, cars and things. We've got a showroom there, and I thought, well, if I sprinkle a bit of sawdust around the floor, I'll be able to cut up some of my own cows and sell them over the counter as sides of beef. That sounded okay to me, because I'd get at least double the price that I'm getting now, and the housewives would be able to buy beef at a fraction of the cost they're paying at the moment. But before we launched into this, I thought I'd check with the solicitor to see if all was well. I got back the equivalent of about a four-page reply outlining all the various breaches of the acts, federal, state, local health authorities that I'd be breaching. I just wonder, who are all these laws supposed to be protecting? People tell me they're protecting the consumer. Well, I can't see that they're protecting the consumer if in fact they effectively double the cost that the consumer has to pay for a product. I should just refer the Workers' Party platform again to see what we have to say on consumer protection. The aim of consumer protection laws, this is quoting from the platform on page 15, the aim of consumer protection laws is to protect the rights of consumers. It's immoral to legislate to protect consumers if, as a consequence, the rights of producers are violated. The rights of one group of people cannot take precedence over those of another group of people. The only laws needed are those required to enforce the fundamental principle, that is, that no person or group of persons has the right to initiate the use of force, fraud or coercion against any other person or group of persons. In the realm of consumer protection, the protection against fraudulent practices is essential. But since each person has the right to his own life, laws designed to protect people from themselves are unnecessary and immoral. We advocate a review of all existing laws relating to fraud to make them clearer, more understandable and more enforceable by any individual, even against the largest corporation or, for that matter, the government. The repeal of all existing consumer protection laws that violate individuals' rights, including all laws designed to protect people from themselves. The enactment of a body of law designed specifically to protect individuals' rights against all forms of fraudulent practice. It should not be forgotten that in the free market, consumers would be further protected because, firstly, a good name is an asset to a business and it can best be maintained by fair and honest dealing. Secondly, the use of certificates guarantees and warranties issued by manufacturers and suppliers of goods and services are, in themselves, a protection to consumers. Thirdly, both professional and non-professional people can voluntarily form associations for the specific purpose of maintaining high standards, both in work and behaviour. And lastly, privately owned consumer protection organisations producing journals and magazines would proliferate in a free market. History has shown that compulsory government regulations set to define minimum standards have tended to become maximum quality standards. If back on the subject of me selling my meat direct, if that meat that I sell isn't perfect, there's every chance that I'd go out of business or that I'd suffer severe financial loss through court action. I think that's sufficient consumer protection, and the good point about it is that it doesn't load anyone's costs unnecessarily. There's another gentleman that thinks much like this about consumer protection and over-regulation, and he's in America. His name's President Ford. If we can just quote from the newspaper, September 22nd, the Business Standard newspaper, just quote this section of it. During the last 6 months, President Ford has repeatedly attacked government regulation for contributing to inflation and hampering the economic development of the United States. In his most recent speech on the subject, September 5, Ford accuses the regulatory agencies that oversee transportation, energy and communications of having virtually ruled out competition. He says, what was begun as a protection for consumers now guarantees that in many cases they will pay higher prices than a free market would call for, he said. He said, it is the mulligan stew of government rules and regulations, often conflicting with one another, which has created a nightmare of red tape, paper shuffling, and new heights of counterproductivity. In attempting to further frame the issue of deregulation, an issue some presidential aides believe will be a central theme of President Ford's campaign to be elected president, he's called two formal White House conferences and etc. The rest of the article goes on to outline his thoughts on it and what they're going to do about it. And I think that's very encouraging to see that happening in America. I only wish I could see it happening here. Okay, we mentioned earlier that we've surrendered our freedom to the stage where we can't indulge in free enterprise when free enterprise is defined as the voluntary exchange of goods between two willing people. That sounds simple, but it's impossible to achieve at the moment under the existing rules. And it's an indictment not only on us, but on the government and the bureaucracy who have manipulated themselves into this role of having and using power to control our lives. So that's one problem. A big problem, and I think nothing short of massive but peaceful civil disobedience will solve that one. How did the bureaucrats get to have that much control over us anyway? We know that politicians and bureaucrats can only pull a gun and take disciplinary action against criminals. To get this power over us, they've had to weave a tangled web of complex legislation so that in our present environment, it's almost impossible for any of us to go through a whole week without breaking some law or another. And that's particularly true if you happen to be a company director, and you'll know that if you've looked at the recent provisions of the Companies Act. Many of these so-called crimes, we call them so-called crimes, are in fact victimless crimes. And if we can't see a victim, we can't see a crime. As a matter of fact, now that taxation is being exposed as nothing but theft, the main victim in the case of us not paying our taxes would in fact be the government and the bureaucracy itself, with whom we can't really identify, then perhaps non-payment of tax could become a victimless crime. I see that there's some talk of actually increasing payroll tax again. How many of you are paying payroll tax? It's something that's close to the heart of you all. It's one of the most insidious taxes ever introduced when you realise that companies and employers have to pay payroll tax irrespective of whether they make a profit or a loss. Why should employers be fined? And it is, they are being fined because they are enterprising enough to create employment for people. Anyone employing 20 people has in fact got an additional invisible person on the staff in the form of this burden of payroll tax. If you've only got 5 people on the staff, then you've only got a quarter of a person there. Doesn't sound as bad, but once again the percentages are just the same. Yep, taxation is theft. And theft is defined as forcibly taking something from a person, and it's made even worse by giving him very little in return. If an individual does it, it's called theft. But when a government does it, it's made legal somehow. This and the many other instances of governments being permitted to do things that people can't gives rise to the question that if the government derives its power from the people, where does the government in fact get its power to do these things that if the individuals did them, they'd be illegal? The individual and not the government is really the ultimate source of authority. Thomas Jefferson once phrased it, and I'll quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the individuals." One of the main things that's gone wrong in Australia fundamentally is that we have ceased our vigilance over the government and allowed it to overstep its true and proper roles. As you are aware, the Labor government's taxation attack on the rural sector has been primarily by means of reducing your capacity to depreciate capital investment. Our Workers' Party policy with regard to taxation would enable a farmer to have more of his own earnings left to himself to spend. This would mean that you wouldn't be getting ripped off in the good years and starving in the lean. Furthermore, a more rational business-like basis for depreciation, such as previously existed, would be restored to give incentive for capital investment and development of farming property. As mentioned before, this problem of the loss of freedom, not having a free market on which to deal, is one problem. And the aspect of taxation brings me to problem number 2, and I see that as being equally important.
At this point, please do not fast forward the cassette, simply turn over and play side 2.